This is a digital recording of the Senate's Executive Committee of March 1st, 2012.
You're in charge.
Yeah.
Actually, on the 29th, I was. If you wanted it, then you should have come. I signed it.
Nothing at all.
So, any changes to the agenda?
Looks like a time for a CFA report. It's very short, so any time will do.
Okay.
Oh, I need my other glasses.
Make sure we get to that.
Dr. CFA, huh?
Right. Any objection to approving the agenda? Right. Well done. Minutes of February 16th. Any thanks to Richard's iPhone for providing the audio recording? It worked. Any corrections?
I sent some to Laura.
Yeah, thank you.
Great. I didn't find it funny.
It wasn't a very funny meeting.
No, it wasn't. Or what's for? Was it Kelly? Kelly was trying. At the end of it, it's so grim.
All right. Any objection to approving those?
No.
Okay. I've received no correspondence that I can think of. I'll just mention in my report the Green Music Center Advisory Board meets a week from tomorrow, second meeting of the year, and hopefully we've submitted one item from the University Affairs Committee to be on that agenda, which is the proposal I mentioned to you previously for ask the advisory board to put on their fundraising agenda money to support a enhanced program in the music department, or in performing arts, but beginning with music. So we'll see how that goes next Friday. That's all I feel like I should be saying other things, so feel free to ask me.
So I apologize. I need an algorithm for we're on the new augmented Senate Budget Committee. Where does that get reported?
Good question. Now would probably be a good time to talk about that. So maybe okay. I'll give a brief overview and then chime in other people here who were at that meeting. So the Senate Budget Subcommittee, augmented by a couple of department chairs, has been tasked by the provost with trying to craft a set of guiding principles for budgetary decisions in academic affairs. And so that group is trying to hash out what that might look like. There's a lot of, like I reported, I think at our last meeting, there's fear among some faculty when they hear that what that means is providing something for administrators to point to when they
right.
cut people and saying, well, these faculty said it was okay. So so that's a reality we're trying to, it, that fear is a reality we're trying to think about as we think about how to craft such principles. We got a really helpful Karen Jaffe, who's one of the department chairs on that group, took the question to the social science department chairs council and had a great conversation and came back with various kinds of suggestions that might go on such a list, and that helped us think about how to categorize suggestions, how to think at different levels and different ways in which you might frame principles. Certainly nothing concrete, I don't think, to say yet, but Margie and Deborah, feel free.
I think that was a really good description of the process. It was helpful to finally have something to work with rather than wonder what we were supposed to work on or with. And so my memory is at the end of the meeting, you said you guys were going to go to science and technology, and we'd love to have somebody to get the same kinds of things from the same bodies around campus would be really helpful, even just to see how they do or don't match up, what the overlap is, what the shared sense of it was. The other thing I thought was really good is that even though the document she brought back said priorities at the top, the language of it, what was actually on it, was all principles. It was, none of it was rank this over that. Which was great, because it gave us the language to get started with. So.
And at least one or two of those open lunches, we'll figure out some way to phrase that question. I mean, the way the provost phrased the question to the committee when he charged it several weeks ago was, given budget realities, what do you want this university to look like in 5 years? Something along those lines. So kind of a combination of realism and sort of aspirational sort of stuff.
Two questions that came up that I think that actually are things we could maybe give to the provost and sort of say, can you help with this? Because they were essentially informational. One was I just went blank. Christine Renouda from Modern Languages was talking about what's going on in arts and humanities in terms of the experiments around doing a large class with the learning communities, the larger classes and then the smaller breakouts, and that they are seeing this as a strategy not for, again, this was in the context of the, are we supposed to come up with cuts or what are we supposed to do? It's not going to, quote unquote, save money per se, but it will help accommodate higher enrollments overall. And if the overall strategy is either maintaining or increasing enrollment to capture income from that, revenue from that, then here's what we're doing. Basically, she put that on the table. And Michael
Santos,
thank you very much, from Econ. Those economists, they keep asking these business, worse, even peskier questions about numbers. Kept saying, I want to see the numbers. How does this enhance revenue to be able to do this? And I certainly couldn't answer him. I don't know if Lori could answer him. Just a sort of basic, I got the feeling he was looking for something almost formulaic. If you increase enrollment by X amount, right, what does this generate? And then you've got these costs and...
We can get on that.
Okay.
But remember that, you know, as you try to get your head around this, there's headcount and there's FTE.
Right, sure, and all that kind of stuff. And I think frankly...
The headcount is what gives you the money.
Right.
Once you bring in too many people,
yeah,
the only way you can deal with them is to not let them take too much FTE.
Right. So the... I think, frankly, that's at too fine a scale for really what we should be doing, but it was an important question to him. The second one was, I think you just answered it, there are people on the committee who feel like if our charge is to talk about things that are essentially a longer-term view, taking the long view, 5 years feels like a very long time when we could be dealing with a $9 million hit in January, then is there any point to doing what we're doing? Because it's all could be rendered moot by decisions that are made December 31st. So that was an issue that I think caused the group to go around and around a bit and had nowhere to go.
I can just comment because I don't have a statement to make today. I'm guilty of putting that committee up and then kind of being very vague about what their charge is.
Yes.
Because it's very difficult. But I felt that the
happy
last meeting,
which is
the one I managed to attend, because unfortunately I couldn't go to the first one,
right,
that by talking amongst ourselves, we seemed to get some clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And the clarity was, I'd like them to be able to be the conduit to get out and start discussion all over campus.
Right.
Because we must start hearing different views from across campus. The other reason it's becoming a little clearer is that we now have a statement coming out of the Chancellor's office about the budget cut. So we now know that, yes, there is a potential of $9 million, but it's two phases. So we have to implement cuts for July 1, which take care of the structural deficit. So we now know we have our marching orders to take care of that immediately. And that's something that we're just going to have to do quite fast.
And that's the 2.3 million. I'm sorry. The structural deficit is
the 2.3 million
times
another 2 million or so of money that we haven't managed to find for the current fiscal year.
Gotcha. Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
So there's a structural deficit, depending on the day, of around $4 million. Don't put that in the mail. So that's that part. The marching orders from the Chancellor's office then are to put a plan together to deal with the what-if scenario when the next 4.6 million comes, should the trigger be pulled in December. And so adding the two together, you come to about 9 million. But we don't have to implement anything, thankfully. And so there's a lot of political saber rattling here, where the Chancellor really does want a catastrophic plan from the CSU presidents that he can then go to the legislature with, go to the trustees with. That's his ammunition to really make noise over the next few months. But having said that, every university does have to put a plan together to say how they're going to accommodate another 4.6 million. Now, that's nasty. But that's what we need faculty input on. We must start the discussion. And as we go through that, perhaps some good things will come out of it, because maybe we will find a way forward and we will become that university that's leaner and meaner in 5 years' time and better. And hopefully we won't have to implement that cut. But we need the discussion. And if we just sit back here, and I'll come to that next meeting and I'll bring a whole set of examples of what other universities are doing and how you do this. I was reading about, it's amazing, University of Southern New Hampshire is now called the No Frills University. They had to deal with draconian budget cuts. They went into it, they said, the only thing that we want to preserve is our mission to teach students. They cut everything else. No international programs, no co-curricular activities, no outreach to the community. It's unbelievable. Did away with the student union, did away with the student cafe. And they made it. Now, I'm not saying that that's where we're going, but we better look around America. This isn't just the CSU. Universities are hurting out there, and we will have to change. So we have to change immediately in July, and hopefully we won't have to change quite as badly as the No Frills University in January. But we need to start the faculty talking, and everyone will take it seriously. The president's putting out a statement about the budget, hopefully this week.
If this is going to be the committee where a lot of these ideas are coming forward, I think it's absolutely necessary to have some student input on that committee. It would, so if nothing else, so that the students can have the conversations among themselves to know what's going on and kind of hear how it's going down. I think a student's input to the committee itself would be incredibly helpful and vital, but I think the students have the right to be up and up on it also.
And that, I'm pushing hard that that statement that the president puts out goes to all the students as well.
You know, it's interesting. Can I answer on that? Because when we were first trying to figure out who should be on the committee, Paul, we went back and forth, because the other group that feels very nervous about this committee, it, oddly enough, is the deans.
Yeah.
Everybody's afraid that this committee will be making decisions. And I'm going to go back to what the provost said a minute ago. We don't make any decisions. What we do is gather information. So obviously one of the constituents, you know, the vision for this thing has evolved rather dramatically over time, but originally one of the ideas was that this would be a group that would invite people who were in certain capacities, like the deans, to come in and talk about their vision, their ideas, that kind of thing, and just to sort of compile all of this stuff together. And then essentially we exist to inform, we're the Senate's budget subcommittee, the academic Senate, and then academic affairs on that. So students belong in the group of people that we need to have come in and talk about this. But like the deans, we asked if they could be people who came in and participated and let us get as many people at the table that way, rather than make the committee so big that nothing happened. I'm going to flip back to what you just said a minute ago, because now it sounds like we're supposed to be coming also up with priorities and cuts, and that's not...
I think we just need ideas. We need any ideas. No. But I think we need communication across the campus. I mean, I want people talking about this.
Okay.
So that they know that this is real, and that, you know, now is a chance to have input in what we might do to make this happen. And I'd love them to have input in the nasty plan, you know, that we have to put forward about the 4.6. I mean, we don't want that to just be all made up should we suddenly have to implement it. It really needs to be solid and well thought out, and hopefully will never happen. I'm assuming that that's something we just don't want to worry about, but we should still have a conversation about.
So I was next, and then several others. I think we're treating this like the provost report, which is good because he said he didn't have a separate report. A couple of things. I think it would be perfectly appropriate for that committee to ask the student, ask associated students to send a rep. I don't think it would make it too big, and I do think that just from a sort of representation point of view and transparency, that kind of stuff, we that would be great. And it's one of our committees that doesn't have a standing student representative, but anyway, so we can talk about that with the group next time we meet, maybe, and I'll communicate with Paul. It's a, you know, like all our meetings, it's an open meeting, so I'd invite Paul maybe for that one to see if AS wants to send somebody to it, and then we can talk at the meeting about whether we want to try to add somebody permanently. I don't know if there's likely to be any objection, but I'm finding, Andrew, that I'm spending way too much time. When you bring up examples like that, yeah, all of a sudden, everybody across campus is saying, the provost wants us too, and then citing yeah, our example. So yes, I want to urge you to be a little careful in sharing examples like that, yeah, as they get taken as what you're pushing us to do. So I've had to,
oh, yeah,
you know, try to talk down people saying he wants us to do what Arizona State did, because that's what you brought up at a recent meeting. And so,
no, don't repeat it.
Reinvent themselves several times in some disastrous ways and some good, but whatever, I don't even know. But so, you know, I take it as, look, people are doing big things, and it's possible to do big things, but what people hear is the specifics of the big, particular big thing you mentioned, and get worried about that. So,
I take your point, but also I don't mind taking the heat for things that get misinterpreted, because if nothing else, it stimulates discussion, and if it comes back to me and I get accused of, you know, doing something weird and wonderful, at least it's getting the word out, and the seriousness of it's getting out. But I also hear, and I'll try and be a little more careful, but, you know, again, we really need people to be thinking about that. And so when they hear, and I also think, you know, you almost have to give examples for people to grasp some of the ways forward. I mean, the No Frills University, I just read about it today, and it just kind of blew me away. But in some ways, you know, they survived and they came out of it, and they're still doing what they're meant to do. And just because they don't have an international program doesn't make any difference. So,
right. So,
but I hear you.
So, a couple of things. I think people are taking it very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, last time you were worried, you said Larry is saying that nobody's taking it seriously, and now I hear you saying people aren't taking it seriously, and I just don't buy it. People are panicked, and I don't think it's actually any good to try to ramp up the panic by phrasing everything in a "the sky is falling" kind of way. And I know that's the president's statement, you know, that you're trying to get him to put out there, is trying to tread the, you know, kind of a knife edge between "the sky is falling" and "let's try to get through this together" kind of.
Looks more like the sky is falling.
Oh yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the statement, of course, but I do think people are taking it seriously. What they don't understand is any avenue to have something to do about it, and so that's what I think this group has to provide, and which is consistent with what you're saying. But I don't think the issue is that people aren't taking it seriously; it's that they don't see that there's a route for them to participate. Perhaps that they are having a hard time seeing any positive direction for this to go. So that makes it a little hard to get excited about participating as well.
Deep. I mean, I just to answer that. I mean, I believe firmly that we should be having open forums, but it just doesn't seem to be happening. So that's the frustration of trying to just work within academic affairs. It's a university issue that we need. Everyone to come in and have a charrette or whatever you want it to be. But it is in the statement that that might be something we can do.
The No Frills University reminds me of something you might find interesting, being a Harley driver. Harley Davidson was having troubles here several years ago, and the head person went around and looked at everybody and says, "Are you making motorcycles?" And if they weren't, they got rid of them. You know, and Harley Davidson is doing fairly well today as a result of that. So that is a good strategy. But as you're saying it, I'm thinking, don't you mean get rid of everything except stuff that makes money? You know, because I mean, you don't want to get rid of stuff. But then That brought up another point that, you know, one of the problems that we're having here is the other stuff that makes money. You know, what they do is, you know, they will spend money on stuff that makes money, but they won't spend it for instruction. They'll only spend it to make more money that won't be used for instruction. You know, and that's very unclear on the concept. And so that's another thing is, you know, coming up with a change in attitude so that, you know, this money that we are making, you know, will wind up going towards our instructional mission.
A couple things that could come up since I put my hand up. What I was just going to respond to is, I mean, in a sense, I don't sit on ASI, I can't ask this question there, so I'm asking it here. I think obviously ASI, usually guys should be having discussions about this same issue, because one thing I'm concerned about is if we put, at some point, I'm totally sympathetic or empathetic to the idea of having representation, but at the same time, I mean, there are faculty issues, and if we try to have a particular committee doing everything at once, nothing gets done. So, I mean, I think it makes sense to have something where it's primarily the faculty dealing with it, but I think the students, and but that's not to say that at some point there should be communication between them, but I mean, at some point I think you do have to have committees sort of focusing on particular elements and then cross-communicating. Otherwise, you just end up with a committee trying to do everything. And just sort of in reaction to what the provost said. I mean, I understand that ideas are given and then there's this sort of panicked response to them, but at the same time, I think these kinds of ideas are useful just to give a broader variety of things to be thinking about. Maybe we would reject that out of hand, but at the same time, it does cause you to or force you to think beyond parameters that you might be thinking. So
maybe a big list of possibilities, including some that are self-contradictory, and it's pretty obvious you're not.
That's
right.
I've actually started a list. That's what I meant when I come to that next committee. I'm
good.
Trying out a list. Which is my suggestion.
Right.
Well, actually, it was on that very theme. I was thinking that if you actually present mutually exclusive options, then and say I'm thinking of, you know, that we should be thinking of these things, it'll offset that a lot. But I also agree that it would be useful to have these channels where it gets seen that these conversations are happening, because these conversations have all been happening. The problem is Larry doesn't recognize that they've been happening, and often they're happening quietly amongst ones and twos of people as they're thinking about, do I polish up my CV and start looking elsewhere? And we'd rather have it not be in that mode. So I do think, though, maybe you came from places with more rational history, but we've got people who are reacting from prior experience here, and so they can't help but conflate some of the current things with the things they've been socialized through in the past, and so it may be a perfectly reasonable, you know, example or something to use in certain places, but not for this particular population.
And I'm just my last comment, and I hope that when this statement comes out from the president, and certainly as I've started to tell this group here, and I hope it will start permeating through the campus, it is now a two-phase problem. It wasn't last week.
Wasn't
we had
right.
No clarity.
Yeah.
We didn't have a clue whether it was July 1 we'd find $9 million.
Yeah.
That's not happening. We just have to fill the structural deficit, and we've got a lot of plans for that, and that can happen without too much visible pain. So the campus shouldn't feel that we're going down some spiral. We now know what we have to deal with in the July 1 budget. The plan with the meltdown is really, I believe, and what I heard from the Chancellor's office is that he wants to just take those 23 campus plans, cherry-pick the scenario of what it will look like for the CSU, and go forth. And so, to me, it's very political, that part. And I'm also hearing things like system fixes and who knows what the trustees will come up with. So I don't want the campus to start panicking about $9 million.
Right.
Yes. Good to know. It could be worst case scenario, and it would be remiss of us not to mention it and be truthful. But let's focus on the first cut and then plan for if we have to trim something.
Yeah, and then I guess the last thing that I was sort of wanting to put in there too, though, is I think we're having with your arrival a greater opening between the provost position and the faculty than we've had in a while. And so that's the other thing that makes me a little bit worried about is there are people who might conflate you with your predecessors. And so that's something I very much want to try and help prevent, because I think those that have been working with you so far see a very different pattern. And so we want to keep that opportunity open. So we didn't want you to lose an audience before you had the chance to actually execute. So.
No, I appreciate that.
Don't use the word execute.
I meant in the business sense, but I didn't. Yeah, but I take your point.
So a couple more, and then I want to get on to some business items. Paul.
Yeah, I hear the. I think students wouldn't want to be a part of the faculty issues conversation any more than faculty would want students to be a part of it. I guess I'm a little unclear, and maybe I guess. Sounds like I'm not alone on kind of where this is going, but it sounds like we're talking about coming up with ideas for how to meet these budget cuts from the academic affairs arena. That is a conversation I am adamant that students should be a part of. If it's, I don't know what, I guess having, that's kind of my point. I think if it's a committee for that is dealing exclusively with faculty issues, you know, RTP, whatever else, then I think that's a different conversation, but I mean, if we're talking about no frills universities or whatever else, I mean, just to make your point that.
Yeah, wait till I go back to staff meeting. Yeah.
No, but honestly, I think it's students have to be a part of this conversation. It's we're a big piece of this university.
John.
This might come out as a snarky comment, but it sort of builds on what Richard said and some of the history and just some of my own perception. And that is personalities presently on campus and some that aren't, and this is in no way directed at you, is that oftentimes discussions aren't going on only because what is coming out of those discussions is not what they want to hear. So it's not an absence of discussion, it's an absence of preconceived outcomes. So.
Matthew.
Can you use an example that doesn't eliminate student therapy? That would be a great help to me.
Polishing up that resume, huh?
Corpus Christi, Texas A&M. For me, the conversation, because it's for me, is that I really believe so strongly in what Sonoma State is and working with all of you. And for me, when I try to think about budget cuts, I look at folks like Paul and the leaders for a democratic society that all of us put into that in some way. And so I worry about us doing these kinds of cuts in camps. And I think what I heard the provost say a little bit about is we should really be having a larger conversation with all of us involved. And if you have to be the model for that to get the conversation started, I just want to make sure that we all get to the point where we say, as you all design courses, what is that endpoint and how do we preserve those key components of what we're proud of when folks get degrees from here that make us unique, that make our students amazing, and how do we preserve those? Because some of them are, a lot of them are in the classroom, but there are a few that are outside too. So how do we have that both-and conversation versus either-or? I do agree with the problem. Sometimes you have to put crazy things out there so people go, oh, wait a minute, let's not do that. But I hope that we can work together to forward this, because my mission in student affairs is in support of academic affairs and what you do. And we try to add polish to what you do. We try to give real-life safety lab classes to what you do so it's not a catastrophic or an execution event when they try that new theory they've learned. So I think it's a together thing, and I hope that student affairs will eventually get asked to this conversation, because I can do all the planning I want, but I only have like $2.50, and I can only split that so many ways. And lastly, is that student affairs has come to the table with more money than it was allocated for its budget. So I hope that that's somewhere in someone's head, is that we've been asked to give more several times already before, so there's really damn little left. And when we have one career counselor for our classes, they're all going to be looking to all of you to do the career counseling more. So there's workload issues and all that. So again, if we look with what do we want our students to look like, I think that helps us make decisions about the support services that our students need.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. On that note, business item number one, Margie.
One moment, please. There we go. So recommendation is coming forward to this body from Structure and Functions, and I believe this is one that does not go on to the Senate? We'd make,
I think the Senate approves.
Does the Senate approve, so this would just comes to here?
What is ASIP?
Yeah, what is ASIP?
The Academic Council for International Programs. Okay. This is a recommendation for the faculty person who essentially has Robert Train's job. Does that make sense? Okay.
Yeah.
No, you don't know. Okay, so this is the person who is the head of our international programs advisory, academic advisory board. Is that the right way to put it? The faculty member who's connected to and works with Marissa Thigpen's office. Okay.
Got it.
But the appointment is to the CSU Academic Council on International Programs.
Yes, thank you.
It's kind of a local practice that person also works well, and it said in the call this person will work closely with SSU's International Programs Office, which is Marissa's office.
Okay.
And so it's kind of a combination of the two. The CSU level, it's SSU's representative on the CSU's Council on International Programs, plus the local faculty most involved with our own local international programs office.
Okay. So it was in at the last second a very hotly contested position. It was interesting. Mm-hmm. We ended up with, why can't we get this for all faculty governance? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 people applied for this position.
Wow.
Is Robert Trade one of them?
No.
Because he's done. He's coming off of it.
And so the faculty member that we selected from this list is Teresa Alfaro-Velkamp from the History Department. So that's our recommendation to you.
And the rest, we propagated the other ballot that didn't get pulled, right?
Yeah.
The students who are now running for a chair, vice chair. They just don't know it yet.
The consolation prize. You're now chair-elect. Okay, so that's a recommendation coming from structure and functions. Is there any discussion?
Right. Do we get to know who the others were?
I don't know. Do we do that? I don't know how
curious.
That goes. I'm looking to the authority. We had people from arts and humanities. We had people from business and econ. We had people from social sciences. We had people from science and technology. Mm-hmm. So it was a good crowd. It wasn't, you know, all in one school or all in one department or anything like that. It was spread across the university. What's the?
It's something that we don't have a clear policy on about.
For any of these positions,
whether nominees are public. For elections, we had a conversation last year and decided that those were public since they were going to become public on the ballot.
Uh-huh.
For appointed positions, it's not as.
It's a gray area.
Clear.
So I'm not quite sure.
So
I think that I recall from the past is you don't want to recreate the discussion here. Mm-hmm. You had instruction functions. And a lot of time what seems to be helpful is to say why you chose that.
Excellent. We can do that. Well, it was interesting because the people who applied, there were a couple of people who clearly actually didn't have the same degree of experience that some of the other people did, especially specifically with international programs for students in the CSU. They had been abroad, and that's great, but that's not quite the same level of experience as some of the other candidates had, many of the other candidates had. So that created a small cluster that sort of fell to the bottom fairly quickly. And then we looked at the previous, I think it was like four people who had held this position. And they were all in one school, and so there had been a recommendation that that we think about moving it, because we had such a broad range of applicants that we could move it to another school. And so that then created another sort of clustering of candidates. And then it was interesting, we got some input from Marissa about someone who had been to see her and asked about the position and what programs were like on campus. And this was someone who had already been working with her as a reviewer for, you know, how you review study abroad applicants and things like that. And it turned out that this was the only person on the whole list who had actually made any outreach to Marissa at all. And that kind of helped to have her stand apart.
Interesting.
Yeah. Does that give you some context?
Yeah.
Cool.
That's good.
Yeah. Any more questions or discussion on this one? Any objection to approving Professor Alfaro Belkin? Okay. She's approved.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks to her. It's a 3-year position. Great. All right, let's go on to number 2. Every year, the executive committee has to approve the request of the provost. This is the same assigned time for faculty governance as is happening in the current year. No changes proposed.
This is for the year, Ben?
Yes.
Okay.
So, standing committee chairs one course release a semester. Those three subcommittees, the three sort of historically highest workload subcommittee chairs, one course for the year, one unit each for lecturer centers.
I was a little curious under where it says courses, it says no change.
Yeah, that could just say that that's not on a course basis. The rest are on a course basis, but the lecturer centers are just one unit. That's not a
Okay, and so there's three lecture senators?
Right.
Okay.
Right. Got it. Yeah, so it's total for the three lecture senators. Any conversation? Any objection to my forwarding this request to the provost?
Should we pass it down to people?
I think he's got it.
Oh, he's already got it.
I will have a conversation. All right. Thank you. I'll roll. Let's do business item number 3.
Yeah. In a sense, we can actually do business items 3 and 4 together if people are game for that. And just to actually start out the gate with a little bit of reframing already, when I was putting the request forward, I probably didn't do it clearly enough. I wanted to not frame this in terms of a revision to either of these because it isn't a revision. We are starting from scratch with two new separate policies that aren't building on the old language. So we aren't doing a markup comparison, any of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. What we are doing is we are going from one weird, tangled attempt to make it a single policy to deal with actually two different kinds of leaves that actually are specified in two different articles of the CBA. And so so that's why the memo says that we are proposing two new policies. The motivation is that we are currently out of compliance. We don't match the CBA, both in terms of our policies and in terms of our practice. And so so that's the main thing. And then the second thing is that the CBA actually specifies two different pathways for evaluation and approval of these things. And so that's why we decided to actually separate the two of them, because I think that's what really caused the trouble. And actually, if you look at the flows, the workflows or the application flows that we have attached to them, you'll see some places where submits to question mark might appear or whatever in the current practice, because these are places where some of these applications have languished or not quite had a clean handoff. And so we are trying to do two simpler policies with a relatively parallel structure to help make it easier to navigate. And finally, the main thing that I think is going to be very important when we bring it to the floor is that we aren't talking about revisiting the evaluation process in terms of merit. All we're trying to do here is getting compliance. And if we do want to raise the merit and weights and all those kinds of things, that's a perfectly valid conversation to have, but I'd like to have it separately because I want us to get back into compliance as soon as possible. So to highlight the advantages of the two new policies, we think that they clearly map to each of the articles, and they address, as is specified in each of the CBA articles, how the merits will be done, which is the faculty side, and the programmatic needs, that is the logistics and the administrative side. And so they each do that. In the process, we're making each of those pods more transparent and the accountability is there. And one of the places that this came up that was of most significance to us was that sometimes when sabbaticals were given, backfill didn't necessarily go back to that same department. Sometimes if people were denied sabbaticals because they were too essential, there was never any addressing why is it that there's no way to give that person a sabbatical and is that always going to stay the same. So that's the kind of thing that we were trying to bring forward in the accountability and transparency issues. C is just, it's easier. And then the fourth thing is that we also, in the process, we're trying to make all the terminology more consistent, both internally, but also between our policies and the CBA. So then, finally, I think there's some key decisions that are made in the process of adopting these policies. And here's where FSAC and URTPS are actually putting forward some specific recommendations. One is that the Professional Leave Committee, as it's identified in the CBA, be identified as our URTPS, the University Reappointment, Tenure, and Promotion Subcommittee. And that's pretty much what's been happening for the sabbaticals, but the DIP stuff actually changes a little bit that way because departmental input and things like that. So that's one. The second decision that's happening in the way we've presented it is that the appropriate administrator, as identified in the CBA, will be identified as, and here I realize there was an error, it should be schools, plural, and library, singular, deans. So that the policies just say the deans instead of saying the appropriate administrators. It just makes it easier, especially for the faculty who are trying to read these things. And that also is highlighting that a lot of the issues in terms of the accountability really is within the schools and between the schools. And then finally, and this one I actually ran the policy by Ruben before we brought it to you here to make sure that this wasn't going to be a surprise recommendation to him, was that in the CBA, the president is identified as the one who makes the final decision based on all the recommendations. We're recommending that this be delegated to the provost because the provost is the one who's dealing with the resources going to the respective schools and would be the one to sit there and say, well, why isn't it happening this way or not? And could he reallocate maybe if the school itself can't reallocate, but it makes that dean's actions about allowing somebody to go or not, or recommending that somebody be allowed to go or not. It seems to put it in the right place. So that's our point. So I'm hoping that laying all this out this way and then introducing it this way when we get to the floor will make this as painless a process as it can be. I am expecting to get some questions, especially on that third recommendation. I know that's going to require some explanation.
You're about to get one.
Yeah.
5 seconds from now.
Okay.
So your explanations cover both of them.
And so what we've done just finally is they are separate. They're in the same orders with the same kind of structure and using similar kind of terminology. But you will see that there is a difference in that when the applications come in for the sabbaticals, we have that level going in. The faculty aren't reviewing at the departmental level for the sabbaticals, right? What we are seeing at the departmental level is the input on resources in the departments. The difference in pay. Let's see, I need to get my glasses back on. Let's see. Yeah, actually, it may be easiest even to be looking at the charts. And so when we look at
the algorithms,
I would just call it a flow chart. So in the DIP, the applicant submits the application to the department RTP leave committee, right? And who then notifies the chair of the intent, and so then it shunts down the chair's direction for the logistical input that goes into the dean, but then the department is looking at the application for quality. Okay, so that's where we, this is actually where we ran into so much trouble, was even the departments themselves would get confused. Are we supposed to be evaluating the sabbaticals? No, that's supposed to be your TPS. Are we supposed to be evaluating the dips? Yeah, we are. And the articles specify that. So, yeah. So that's where it is.
So, yeah, back to the three recommendations. So, certainly the first one, it seems like we could call the URTPS our professional lead committee, and the second one, we can say that the deans are the appropriate administrator. But in three, it sounds like we're going to say the provost is the president, and that seems like something we cannot define. I mean, if we're trying to make this go with the CBA, and the CBA says it's the president, then it sounds to me like it has to be the president, unless he chooses to designate someone else.
This is delegatable, and by his giving approval to the policy, that's his action of delegation, right? And so if saying that on the floor helps make that easier, because he is approving it, so he's saying, okay, I am delegating this authority to the provost. He doesn't actually relinquish his authority. I mean, somebody could appeal back to the president. He's still got the ultimate appeal process. He's not abdicating and not able to get it back. So what we're saying is that that our policy makes it easier. Who to go talk to? The president isn't of a matter of course wanting to be the one, maybe, who people go to unless they've heard from the provost, and then it's an exceptional appeal.
So to clarify, we're recommending that the president delegate this to the provost?
Yes.
Okay.
And when I ran it back past him, I got a okay.
Okay.
So.
Pass. The question was answered. Thank you.
So that's nice. I was just trying to find it in the CBA copy that you have. But so you're saying that the CBA says that the department does not have anything to say about the quality of an application for a sabbatical.
For the sabbatical.
What is that? You know?
And this is something that we... that surfaced as we were also comparing with some of the other campuses, and it was coming out. So there is a professional leave committee composed of tenured faculty units shall receive the sabbatical applications, right? And so this is supposed to be, this has been interpreted as being, there's one committee that's supposed to be doing it for all of us. It's not supposed to be in every department there's one of these, right, is what we were seeing. And so in many other campuses, there has actually been a separate sabbatical committee that's doing it. And so what we were thinking of is, instead of setting up a whole separate committee, we were thinking the RTP folks are, up on all this kind of stuff, and they were willing to do it, and it means that we don't have to launch another committee and elect people to be on it. It seemed a natural fit. So that was in 27.5. So,
yeah. Okay. So 27.5 doesn't say to me that that's the only committee that reviews. So it's not a clear-cut case to me that you're just going for compliance here. It seems like a pretty... And perhaps, see, I don't know what practice has been in other departments. In my school, I believe it's typical for the departments to review the applications and write a letter that gets attached as it goes on up, and then it does eventually make its way to the URTPS, which then satisfies the conditions of the CBA. The CBA doesn't say there shall be no prior levels of review, and so that's...
It doesn't preclude it, you're right. That is correct. What we were finding is that the previous policy, our current policy was trying to carry through prior practices before the CBA actually came in. If we look to when these patterns got established, they were pre-bargaining, and so we never really did a rework of the policy when we had a collective bargaining agreement. And I think actually it would have been good if we had had a clearer conversation back then. And so what ended up happening was that was the way that through practice we were trying to make both the dip and the sabbatical echo. But what we've been finding, and this came from URTP DPS is that they were saying they were getting a number of questions. We had divergent practices in the schools and departments. And so it wasn't that everybody was all doing it all the same way, and it wasn't the same. It was actually we got different practices, and that's part of what was the problem. And so by the time it got up to URTPS, they were getting different kinds of packets, and deans were having different levels of influence in these things too. And so we were trying to go for consistency across all the faculty.
I guess my only, my struggle is that for sabbatical applications, which eventually have to be ranked, or at least the top, you know, there's a specific cutoff that you really have to evaluate quality of proposals, and that's awfully difficult to do on a generalist committee, and it feels like the input of your disciplinary colleagues is pretty important in that process. And so I understand that differential practice across departments and schools has been problematic, but I'm not sure that getting rid of all those other layers of review is the way to do it. Deborah.
So I come from a culture that has a separate professional leave committee. And when I go back to, for example, to our faculty governance reassign time and I consider workload, I'm sure the committee members now of our URTP. So when we're talking about a policy that we're putting together now, members change. Even the president may change.
Yep.
So that being said, the URTP has, if you look at the faculty reassign time, one course, not being familiar with this, I'm just considering, and many of you around the table are, how many dossiers come up for RTP and how many sabbatical requests come up to the same committee, when do they come up, and what would the workload look like at any given time, being fair to our colleagues.
Yeah. So these tend to come up in the fall. They come through earlier. The sabbaticals and dip requests tend to come up. And actually, another thing that's being proposed in here is that they're actually separate. Now you'll notice that when somebody applies for a sabbatical, on the very same form, they might say, if I don't get a sabbatical, can I do the dip? And the problem that was also being discovered, not just from URTP trying to decide these things, but also when it gets to the end, the allocation of resources is different if it's a dip leave versus a sabbatical leave. And so that was coming at the end of the year and was ending up being problematic because schedules and other things like that were already fixed and in place, and then something else was happening. So so in this process, you would actually have to apply different, you know, put in a sabbatical application and a dip application if you're trying to go for one or the other. So that is something that I hadn't mentioned actually before that I think maybe I should highlight. So note that.
But coming off of that, then, if we're just asking if this is Senate ready,
right.
We have once again digressed.
Well, no, because it's really complicated. So trying to anticipate some of these things could help us have documents ready that might make it easier.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So, readiness is good. I was just thinking before you said that it's lucky for me that Terry wasn't here because he would have shouted down my head. John.
Well, given that conversation, this really isn't a readiness. It's more of a substance.
Yeah.
And you get to say it on the floor, unlike me. I have to
right.
Jennifer.
I read this. And now I answered my own question.
All right,
take it back.
So relinquishing. So, just to reiterate the point that you were having coming in, though, that we would want to be ready to be addressing is the idea of relinquishing departmental review in the sabbatical process. Right.
But 27.6, not my term.
Okay. No, but see, notice that 27.6 in the Article 27 is saying that a copy of the application goes to handle the logistics, but that's more to the chair, right? How is it going to be, right? That's not the faculty saying, yeah, that's the more logistical side and resources.
That's the chair letter that says we can get along without you.
Yeah.
Department should provide a statement. Okay, so it's not really the department, it's the chair.
Yeah, the chair is a representative of the department. Well, in some big departments, you'll actually have somebody who's doing the scheduling and things like that instead of just the chair or whatever. So you're not doing some other big schools.
Right.
Yeah. Going back to your number three, your third recommendation.
Yeah.
What is the, why not have it read something like the president or his designee?
Mm-hmm. Or his or her designee.
Or his or her designee. It's designee. So you want it to be specifically provost.
Yeah. And the reason why, and this actually came as much out of URTPS as it did FSAC, it was because practically on this campus, that is the individual who's thinking of, you know, what's happening in the school versus across the schools. Because the idea was if the president was going to delegate it to somebody, we wanted to recommend that it was the provost that it was delegated to and not Larry, you know, or something else, right? Somebody who, for logical reasons, was the delegate, right? And don't put Larry, put the vice president of finance, you know, that's what we're meaning. It seemed like that particular role was the appropriate delegation.
So, I think many of these, we are, you know, getting into substantive comments that are appropriately debated on the floor.
Okay.
I think the only issue with what I said in departmental review is that I don't think it quite matches your introduction as all
okay,
we're doing
right.
is getting into
right, exactly.
becoming
so,
compliant. So
yeah.
it's
yeah.
worth calling out that as a change from some department's
yeah.
practices.
Okay.
Your
yeah.
presentation. So, Sam, I'm sorry. Yeah.
So I hope this is a readiness question. So what if we have a new president and the new president, he or she, does not want to delegate this to the provost?
And then the president would propose a policy change.
But that seems like we're tying the president to have to do that, but it seemed like it'd be easier if Brian's suggestion was taken, that it just say president or designee, and if our current president wants to designate it to the provost, then it satisfies you, but the new one doesn't.
Yeah, although from the faculty perspective, and if the president is willing to do this, you know, the president can override this person, right? The president still has in the CBA the authority, right? And so that president can supersede that, right? So why not say what we want, and why not make whatever incoming president, you know, comes in, see quite clearly what the local practices are going to be, and understand what a shift that would be to local practice if that were to be changed. Does that make sense?
It does, but it doesn't sound to me. It seems like a new president wouldn't have to change this policy. The new president has the authority and can just do it because the CBA says he or she can do it. And so it just seems like we have this bizarre policy that doesn't go with the CBA, and I thought the whole point was to make it go with the CBA. So I don't know. Just,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Here.
Okay. So.
But that's a constant
yes,
issue.
Yes. Yes.
The
yes.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Sorry. But Terry's not here, so.
Somebody had to do it.
Yeah.
We had to go off the rails.
So, anything you think that? And does anybody have any comments that you think would make this inappropriate to put it on the Senate calendar for next?
No. It's ready.
Okay.
So if I had that correction that I had in there, and so then if your point. Then where's my memo? If that memo gets changed so that in that first part, I guess it would be in this.
It's number two.
It's sort of in the second unnumbered paragraph. Right. No, that's the.
I think it would be on the last page. It would be a fourth.
Just add something in here. So four or somehow maybe renumber those things, but just address the change to
address inconsistent departmental and school practice, and you know recommend just one level of review.
Okay.
That'll go over well.
Okay. All right.
And my understanding from your introduction was you'd rather these were called replacement policies than revisions.
Yeah, or when we do the agenda, if we could say... yeah, what I'm wondering is if on the agenda it's not two different business items, because it really is so intertwined, I don't think we really can separate them.
About replacement of existing blah policy, whatever the title
with,
is.
With two
with,
new...
With new sabbatical and VIP policies.
Policies, yeah. I think that's the way to do it. Because I know that if we use the word revision anywhere in there, people are going to say, where's the corresponding language? Mm-hmm. And we'll just waste so much time because there is no corresponding language. Not directly.
This is sort of a readiness thing, but if you're doing tweaking of language to prep it to get it there, I actually really love the language on the flow chart for comparison of workflow for the draft DIP and current DIP policy. But I'm also guessing that someone got a little bit tired by the time they were doing this one. And the language in the very last box that says one magically receives application.
Oh, yeah.
My vision instantly, I went straight to CSU Hogwarts and I've been having a great time over here thinking about what the sorting hat would look like. And, you know.
Yeah.
But I was ready to But I have the CV feeling one. That one, people may think maybe that's too flippant. So,
okay.
I love it, frankly, but. Or exactly how it seems to work.
Or if it's there, it should at least be in quotes.
Yeah.
Right. Because that actually was a problem. Was they were the paths didn't always.
No, I understand
way.
What
yeah.
they're trying to say, but
yeah.
but it just
magically is probably not the right term.
Perhaps.
Yeah. So
we like it.
Come up with some suggestion.
Surprisingly.
Unexpectedly receives.
Yeah.
All right. Any objection to putting this item on the agenda?
Okay. Yes.
All right. It's there.
Good luck, Richard.
Oh, boy.
You're serving wine at the next Senate meeting?
So, anything else you'd like to report, Andrew?
No, I don't think so.
Any more questions for Andrew?
Punished him.
All right. Brian, do you have any statewide reports?
I do not.
Let's see. Margie, do you have any?
Beyond the business item and get out the vote. Oh, and try to remind people, everybody got Laurel's email, that people are voting the slate, but they're not voting the constitutional issue, and we've got to have no turnout. So you could just sort of
remind
people.
Oh, they're not seeing that they're both
getting better. It's only four now who haven't voted for the constitutional.
Who
oh,
have
good.
Voted for
higher before.
It was 19. Yeah, okay. Good.
There's only a lot more voters.
Yeah.
Just a suggestion. I think it would have been simpler if they've both been in the same ballot so that you can't vote for the people without even seeing that you had. If
you
then
can't
it would have been.
Do it, she said.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
You can do
all
it
right.
Because some people can't vote for your
team. Oh, okay. All right.
And also, if we extend that vote longer, we can't close the other one.
I see. Okay. I understand.
Yes. So get out the vote. We need about three times as many as have voted so far.
Votes will magically.
okay. Let's see. Matthew.
Yeah.
Budget's bleak. Just a little bit of good news. There was a verbal offer and acceptance for the Multicultural Center Director position.
Ooh, great.
This AM. I am not comfortable announcing finalist or candidate's name because it's been verbal, and until all signatures are gathered by administrators, I would like just to let all of you, my friends and colleagues, know that it was a successful search. I believe this person has the correct skills and ability to really help us take that next step forward in multicultural affairs and leading that organization. So I'm very pleased.
Great. Any questions? Anything you can tell us about admissions?
What would you like to know?
Well, you know, return rate at our current cutoff and things like that. How are we doing? Too early.
It is still a little early. People are still waiting to hear back from the UCs. We're going to get a bump as soon as all those go out. We have been working with biology and some of the impacted programs to try to get those reviews at the department level. back out to the students, and that's kicked us up a little bit. If I recall correctly from my meeting, I think we're about 50 or 100 deposits over where we were last time for first-time freshmen, and we're a little under that. We're probably about 50 under in transfers where we were last year at this time. However, we're catching up and putting more things and putting more transfer applications out there. Part of that is just the the staff shift. We had so many people leave that unit. Over 4 people leave, and we're kind of reattasking people. So it's kind of people are learning new jobs, trying to get the processing of. I think some of the activities that faculty and that Gustav and his team have come up with, and with Mark Maracol, to try to recruit low-enrolled majors or under-enrolled majors, and reaching out. The president's letter has already gone out. There's a video, so I saw the work plan for that. So thank you for all of your time and efforts to get our students here at a higher index. I think it will help all of us to have that. So we're still holding that the higher 3,200. We haven't dipped below that and haven't offered below that at this point in time. So. If we don't get the numbers, that'll probably be a conversation that'll come back up in enrollment management council cabinet, and I imagine with all of you too, where we need to go to bring in the 1,800 first-time freshmen.
And can we say anything about out-of-state people?
Sure. What would you like to say? Yeah. No, I'm not trying to be flippant.
I don't know.
Sorry,
about numbers or
Typically, we got about 7 folks, and right now I think we already have that in deposits, so I think we're going to have a little bump, but it's still some of the recruitment for the under-enrolled majors are those outside of the area, outside of state, so I'm hoping we will continue to see those numbers maybe double and quadruple. We've already have more international students than we had before, so all those targeted areas that the provost, myself, all of you really worked on and targeted, that's moving forward. So it'll really kind of create a baseline for kind of a low-level effort this year. But as we look at next year and where we need to go and how we need to do things, I know Brian and I have talked a lot about how do we recruit for our amazing new music center and what are the things we can do and sharing information and helping each other to do some of these things. So I think as we move forward, there'll be more of those kinds of efforts with programs. Graduate students, I think also in our wine business program and those kind of things we're looking at. Where are those other areas that we should be reaching out to international students and other places to get students here?
We have had our enrollment cap reduced for 13-14.
Oh, really?
Oh, we have.
Really?
That's going to
interesting.
Give us some logistical issues, which we have to plan for. To what?
To how much?
Cap 2 percentage points down. So
back to 103?
I think we're at about 200 FTEs down on the current one, which means that we're going to have a large bubble of freshmen from mm-hmm. the current year, a large intake next year,
yeah.
and then
a major challenge to deal with that large
classes.
Number of people. So, as I talked to the president, and I'll talk to Matthew and obviously Gustavos, now we be a very good time to get an active recruitment program going for out of state, because we really do have to watch we don't go over target with FTS 13-14.
Okay. See, it's Brian and then Deborah.
So do you anticipate bringing in a class that needs less remediation than before in English and math?
We are hopeful that sticking at the higher index will do that.
It seems like that would be one place to save a bunch of money.
We spend a tremendous amount of money in remedial classes.
Spend a lot of money in them, but they're very cheap per FTES, in math anyway. Cheap per FTES. So if those students take another class instead of the remedial class, then at least in the short term we're not actually saving much. But in the longer run, as they finish earlier, hopefully much higher percentage of them do finish.
It's a little different in English.
Yeah. Right, English classes are held much smaller.
Yeah.
Deborah.
Matthew, I asked this another committee member, and I couldn't remember the name of it, and some CSUs belong to something that honors Western states for admission to their university. Do Humboldt did, so we don't, because you're looking confused.
I Yeah, I am confused.
Okay.
I don't know if there's, are you saying like a sister school agreement where...
It covers the whole western United States side of the Rockies.
I have not heard.
Okay. And what the system is it allows those students to come in as out-of-state students. They pay time and a half the tuition instead of double the tuition. So it might be something that we look into, if I could only think of the name of it. But if you were to call Bob Schneider at Humboldt, he might be able to help you with that. There's an acronym, of course, but yeah. Western something something. Yeah,
I have too.
Yeah.
Actually, this is the way all these states are saying, we'll take yours.
Yes.
We'll charge them a little bit more, but not quite so much more, and maybe they'll come to us instead of the others.
Right.
Are you sure we don't have that? Because
No.
I remember...
Western...
I think I remember we had a student from Hawaii that seemed to be operating under that.
Anyway, we'll look into it.
Yeah.
Cool. Check with Gustavo and see. All right. You just come out to hang. Any more questions for Matthew? All right. Let's jump to John for the CFA report, and then we'll come back to do all the standard things.
Yeah, it's real short. Basically, Andy wanted me to announce that the CFA bargaining team is in mediation session and still working to try to resolve the contract at that level. Mm-hmm. So he's apologized for not being here, but Thursdays aren't a good day for him. So that's it.
Find a nice house in Long Beach yet?
I don't know. Maybe you should.
All right. Let's see. Deborah, do you have any PC updates?
Yes. So we have separated our committee into two tasks right now. And moving along, I'm just really excited about this, which says something a lot about my life. one of them is the MOU that we have with Extended Education. And the second one is the online learning policy. So we each have our marching orders, and we're vetting it out to everybody we can think of before we come forward with the policy. But we're getting really close on both of those.
Any questions for Deborah? All right. Armand's not here. Nobody else is here. It's on APC. All right. Richard.
So, let's see. So we got the, of course, the sabbatical and DIP stuff coming forward. What's in the pipeline is the instructional materials adoption policy, and so we're in a little bit more of fact-gathering phase, but we're also, I'm working with Brantley in Academic Freedom Subcommittee to just start drafting a text for a policy for instructional materials, including textbooks, but not just textbooks, adoption policy. We do plan to, once we have something that's worth looking at, running it by EPC, probably SAC, and of course AFS. What I would like to do is, I suspect things have been kind of quiet on the Senate floor, and I'm worried that that means that the end of the semester is going to be even more frenetic than ever. But we're going to try and bring that one through as quickly as we can, because we want to be able to get two readings before the end of the year. Another thing that just crossed my desk today, but it will require some fast tracks, so we should be looking ahead to getting it onto the Senate floor, is that our grants and contracts policy will need revision to come into compliance with the National Institute of Health's new conflict of interests requirements, because if we don't comply by August, we will not be able to receive funds from the NIH for anything on the campus. So it's pretty minor, but it's one of those little legalistic things that comes through. It might be a candidate for a wave of first reading, since we don't have any discretion or whatever in it, and we're going to be told what language from legal would match it. So that may, but we're definitely going to have to fast track that. And so I'm hoping that maybe by next XCOM we might have that to come through. And then let's see if there's anything else. The FSAC team that are working on the SETI question are going to be meeting with PDS
next week to get some of the professional development subcommittee's feedback on how those things might be useful and hook into things. And I guess that's it from our corner.
Any questions for Richard? Looks like you've been getting some feedback from the email that Laurel sent out, or somebody sent out looking, asking what other people do with
yeah.
And what research.
Yeah, and so we've actually had some volunteers from a few different departments joining the few from FSAC, so it's not just FSAC on. There's some people who have some of them have some professional background in this kind of stuff, too, to help them out. So I think it's going to be a useful thing. I don't think we'll necessarily have stuff that will come forward as full action for the Senate this year, but I think that we'll definitely be in a position to do something interesting next year.
Laurel sent some email to, was it the CSU chair?
Yes, CSU chair.
Okay,
yeah.
Asking for their practices.
Yeah,
and
so
like there's a lot of different stuff.
Yeah, and it's a wide range of things, and we're even looking outside of the CSU folks too for other kinds of practices. And that's partly why we're trying to connect it with PDS too, because sometimes the equivalent of PDS and other at other universities linked those student evaluations into how do we improve our pedagogy? Imagine that. So that's why we're getting some of that. So I think it's going to be, I think it's a good thing that we've opened it. Yeah.
All right, any more? All right, Jennifer.
I have three things. One, we're looking and about to review priority registration applications. So I'm anticipating one, two. But it's all about international and national exchange students. And as part of that, I'm going to draft up a document and put it through SAC about the procedures for reviewing these priority registration applications, because it hasn't been very clear, and I've been very confused about what I'm supposed to do. So one of my last acts as chair, I think, will be to put some nice steps down so the next person will know exactly how to make all of these things happen. You know, because it's very confusing. Also, the student fee referendum code that we have worked on with AS and also with the advisory committee is in a pretty good draft, and it's going to AS again on Tuesday, and I think if they approve it, they will be recommending it to the president, but I will also be bringing it to the Senate, not for approval, but just for information. And I think it's a pretty good draft. I don't know. I'm just looking at you. You've seen it. Just say yes. Smile and nod. and then my third small thing is we have elected a new chair, and it's Karen Thompson, which is a new chair who's an old chair. So go, Karen.
And we're very sad Jennifer is no longer.
She's going on sabbatical.
She's on sabbatical.
Ask her how many days. I bet you she can tell you.
No, I
can't. I bet you Paul can tell you how many days before he graduates.
If you can tell me how many days till you graduate, I can tell you how many days till my sabbatical. It's the same number.
So, any questions for Jennifer? One, it, just out of curiosity, has student affairs during your time on it ever had a conversation about how we do registration the way we give, you know, seniors, juniors, sophomores, freshmen kind of priority? I just asked because I found out that at Cal Poly, they, for instance, rotate. You get a randomly assigned registration appointment every quarter. You know, it's kind of, I mean, you rotate among blocks. So every other quarter, you're in the first half, second half, all the way through. Plus, you have four quarters you get to use a priority registration chip four times during your time, things like that. I'm wondering if we
never have. Would you like us to?
No, I'm not. I haven't heard it coming up. It just was interesting.
Sounds like Disneyland of registration.
Just get a fast pass. fast pass.
Next year.
Right. Yeah, next year, person. Karen can take it up. Yeah. We haven't. I don't think priority registration or registration has been, in that way, has been an issue that we've really talked. I know they cleaned up the list of who got priority registration several years ago, because kind of everybody did, and if everybody does, that really means no one does.
All right. Paul.
Okay, so we had the event, the March 1st event. It's March 1st today. Didn't happen on March 1st because it was raining. And no, we didn't think anybody would want to sit outside in dialogue circles in the rain. So the event has been rescheduled for Wednesday next week. The students who are coordinating the event have done a fantastic job of trying to get the word out, and many of the clubs that had were not able to make it this go-around will be able to make it next week on Wednesday. And so we're excited about that. Kind of means we have to do some replanning and a lot of the logistics have to be redone, but we're hoping to have your support on Wednesday next week, and you all will be able to make it out. And hopefully there'll be more sunshine and less rain. The other thing that's going on in the students' world is campaigns start on Monday next week. So we're hoping there'll be a good turnout for elections at the end of this month. And the candidates are getting real excited. They're stopping in the office and raring to go. So we're excited about that. And yeah, that's about it.
That's a good question. Is there any sense, or I guess you'll know basically once the campaign starts, how much complete turnover there's going to be in student government and then how much continuity there might be?
It's going to be almost total turnover. We have our Vice President for Finance is coming, running again, but he's been here for 3 weeks.
3 weeks, yeah. Four.
A couple months now, I guess. A month and a half, something like that now. And he will be the senior member of the board next year, which we're pretty sure. Well, there's one other senator who's officially running and is wavering on the fence right now about what her year next year will look like. But other than that, we have almost no one coming back.
The reason I asked is it puts the context of the, you know, discussion on campus about the budget and what to do about things in an interesting light, if it means that AS is a brand new slate.
Are candidates public now?
Yeah, the list is public, yes. They can't officially start campaigning until Monday, but yeah, if you ask them, they can tell you. yeah, so it'll actually, I think it'll be, I know it's scary and it sounds scary, but I think it'll actually be a really good year for AS. I think my class, if you will, has been pretty steady throughout. Alex and I are 3-year officers this year, mm-hmm. and most of our colleagues have almost as much, if not the same amount of experience as we do. If not officially, they've been around for as long. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be a lot of turnover. There'll be a lot of new faces and they won't have quite as much background and history on it. But that being said, I think it'll bring some new ideas and some new energy. And I hope the officers will come with some more excitement and won't have been bashed against the sky is falling message for quite as long. And so hopefully they'll come with some energy and some excitement. And we have the advantage of we have some great advisors who have been around for a while and do a really good job of getting those people up and running, and we do a pretty, so hopefully it'll be a good year. It's going to be a lot different. You'll see a lot of new faces, a lot of new ideas, but I think honestly it would be really good for AS and for the students.
Is there any sort of council of elders or whatever that you guys do to help out, you know, kind of like our past chair role?
So our elections end at the end of in March, the week before spring break. Yeah. And so there's a month overlap between the two. And we spend that time trying to do some transition stuff from peer to peer. And then there's training all through the summer. We've rebuilt the way our transition process works this year so it can be more comprehensive. And we're going to require the new officers to be back 2 weeks early. And it's going to be boot camp for those 2 weeks. Historically, it's been you've gotten a weekend of training sort of a thing, and it's been a retreat thing to go away and do team building and some basic training stuff. But we've created the opportunity this year for our professional staff to do a really comprehensive training model with the new officers, and we hope, I mean, it's the first year, so I can't tell you how it's going to go, but we're really excited about it. The professional staff is really excited to be able to implement a true, honest training program and be able to do that.
But I'm also thinking, for instance, you're not graduating even though you're stepping aside. So is there a way that the Associated Students is able to, you know, call you in every so often and say, hey, can you?
Yeah. You won't. I will be around. There's not an official formal means of that, but I'm going to guess that you'll see a lot of me, not in the fall, but in the spring. And,
okay.
You'll see a lot of me. So, that, and our alumni have done a really good job of being resources for us. I mean, we've Bridget and Heather before her, and Jenny, who was two vice presidents ago before Alex, are all really good about being being resources and being, there's not a formal process, no, but it's definitely kind of a fraternity.
Well, Paul, during that 2 weeks, what could anybody around the table, if they choose to participate, do to help?
For the 2 weeks of?
Boot camp.
Boot camp, yes. That's something that we, the professional staff will put together, and one of the reasons we revamped our transition schedule and the way we do that is to try to mirror what the rest of the university's leadership looks like. We historically, the new Senate has come in the last 2 weeks of the school year, and so as everything's getting jammed through Academic Senate, you have a whole new face to deal with. Uh-huh. And it's been tough for the students to come in, and the students who've been working on things all year have to step out, and a new face comes in right when it's decision time. And so we're hoping that this will allow the students who've been working on these projects with all the faculty and committees and whatnot can kind of help finish that process. And then next year, the faculty come back early also. And so we're hoping it will allow to be able to start that process new and together. And so it'll be kind of a mirrored, was one of the reasons we did it.
I think Deborah was hoping you'd say she could come be a drill sergeant.
Yeah, there you go.
Drill sergeant for
Yeah.
All right. Any more questions for Paul? There's an art opening happening at the University Library Art Gallery right now. Women Art and Science exhibit for Women's History Month. Hope you all join me in going over the art opening if you want. Any other items for the order?
Western University Exchange is what it is called.
Got it.
And some of the CSUs do it, and they utilize it. Gustavo was saying when they want to bring in more outside of the area. So. He's going to call him.
This is not Western Governors University.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's
I know we still have to do the agenda, but for the good of the order, School of Ed's accreditation visit, which we've been killing ourselves about forever, starts Sunday.
So just,
Sunday. And goes all day. Yes, Sunday afternoon.
Yeah. What?
And all day Monday and all day Tuesday. So if you see any of your education colleagues, give us a little pat on the back. Tell us we'll be all right.
All right. So for the Senate agenda,
we're going to smush two and three together.
Right. Two and three are joining into one business item. And that is anything else?
No. It looks like the Richard Show.
I was going to say, it's all Richard all the time.
Oh, not you, Richard.
Thanks for giving us an agenda there.
Okay.
Deborah.
So I'm wondering if perhaps we should have that occasional Senate Budget Subcommittee report. Because we haven't heard from them, and it might be, and I know it might be a time to build trust. And
So, Margie, are you willing to talk to Michael and work out who, whether you want to do that or he would do that? Or
I could do that. I'll talk to him. I owe him an email anyway, and maybe I could, yes. He asked me a question I couldn't answer, so you said you could, so you'll have to tell me what to tell him to do. I will do that. I'll get in touch.
Thank you.
I forgot to ask Paul something. So, following up on the Bucks, any news on that?
The box is currently in Chico, I believe.
Okay.
And so we will have the grand total March 5th. Will be, so that's Monday. We'll have the grand total for all the CSUs. Sonoma State collected a little over 1,000.
Oh, wow.
And so we are very pleased about that. Our goal was 1,000, and we exceeded it by about this much. But, and that's, that was a pretty lofty goal.
Goals are good, yeah.
1,000 is a ton for a campus. So.
You and Alex were scribbling stories.
Writing with your left hand. You know.
Okay, so back to the agenda. Any other things? So we'll put the Senate Budget Subcommittee report on. So maybe you can let me know if there's particular
yes.
time needs.
I will.
Or something like that.
Right.
If you decide that you should do it, that'd be great. Okay. Anybody know that they want a time certain for a report? All right.
You can't have a report. You have all three
agenda
items.
I have too much
items.
Stuff.
Yes.
No, I'm just
kidding. What's going to be left to say after all that?
I don't want any more business. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any objection to approving the agenda?
Nope.
Okay. Any more items for the good of the order? Nope. Men's basketball team had a big win in their first playoff game.
Woo!
So that, I think that was their only home playoff game. So for now, I have
to
follow them. And vote. Get out the vote. Pass it around. They'll wave you.
Vote early, vote often.
Monday.
Vote early. Congratulations.
We need